This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, David Prutton, in for Mark Clement, who's having a well-earned break and no doubt sunning himself somewhere exotic. Not that we're in the slightest bit jealous, because we are in the presence of greatness this week as we chat all things EFL with two gentlemen who plied their trade at every level within the English football pyramid. Our first guest is the former Peterborough United, Palace, Newcastle United and West Brom striker who's now smashing it in the Potteries for Stoke City.
Obviously, I knew what big of a club it was and where it had been previously, and I just wanted, with the project here, with a lot of the boys, I just wanted to get involved and hopefully try to push them back to where they need to be.
And we'll be having a cosy catch-up with a former Cheltenham Town and Burnley defender who's currently tasked with getting Barnsley promoted back to the Championship once he gets out of the honeymoon suite of a North Devon hotel.
Nice hotel, nice golf course to have a little look over and have a little wander this afternoon before the game.
It's the official EFL podcast. Okay, our first guest today on the official EFL podcast has a wealth of experience across all four divisions of the English game, with a razor-sharp 145 goals in 362 games. That's Wikipedia, so if it's wrong, blame them. This past weekend saw him register his first goal for the side he joined last summer in a 4-0 thumping of Reading. It's Stoke City's Dwight Gale. Dwight, thank you very much for joining us.
No worries. It's nice to be here and obviously speak with you guys.
Well, thank you very much. Back amongst the goals, is it a case as a striker, given your experience, do you just trust the process, keep doing the same things and the goals come back?
Yeah, of course, after it goes on a bit longer than expected, it starts to get a bit worrying. Hmm. But hopefully now I've got it, I can continue and get a few more.
Is it a case of, I mean, as I said, given your experience in the game, the goals that you've scored over the course of your career, you know it's in there. Is it just a case of making sure that you stick to your fundamentals, your principles, everything that served you so well for so long?
Yeah, of course. I try to arrive in the same sort of areas and try to, do the similar things that I always done. But when it's not going, sometimes I'm sure other strikers would experience it. It's just not going to be their day sometimes. But if you continue doing the things, I'm sure it will turn out right eventually.
What have you made of Stoke City so far this season? You've joined, obviously there's been a change in manager, there's work to do, I think that's safe to say, given the squad and the size of the club.
Yeah, it's obviously been a bit of a stop-start season for us, really. I think we've showed glimpses of the right things, but just not often enough. We've obviously played some good games against some of the better sides in the league, but then perhaps lost to some of the ones perhaps at the bottom where we're competing against at the moment. So at the moment, I think we just need to try to get a bit more of consistency and then see where the season takes us.
It's a funny one, isn't it? Because this season, unlike any other, where we had a big break for the World Cup, what was Stoke's approach in that? Were you at the training ground most of the time? Did you manage to get away? Was there a case of being away from each other from a little bit?
We had a week off from the last game, which is against West Brom. Then we went on to a week in Dubai training, and then we just was back at the training ground with a few pre-season games. And then we was back into it, to be fair. But I unfortunately picked up an injury in the last couple of days before we was due to start back. So
yeah,
I've been out for maybe 4 or 5 weeks already, and then they're just getting back into it at the moment.
How do you find getting back into it? Because, and I say this because I'm a lot older than you are, so it's fine. When you are at a certain stage of your career, you're 33 now, you don't bounce up as quickly as you used to, but you've always struck me as a very agile player, one that looks after himself. How has it been getting back towards what you'd call your full fitness?
Yeah, it's been good, really. I think the staff at Stoke are really good with it, and they've looked after me. I found that the sessions are really difficult, obviously, in rehab, but it obviously gave the better opportunity that when I eventually got back, I was at a better level fitness-wise. So, big thanks to them.
You say big thanks with a little smile on your face. Having been in that position as well, it's brutal, isn't it, getting back to where you need to be?
Yeah, it's not where you want to not where you want to be, really. I think those sessions where you're getting back to full fitness in rehabs can be the toughest ones, really. It's not as difficult when you're working hard with the rest of the team. You've got that mental just extra bit where you're playing with team and it's really thinking about it. When you're on your own, sometimes it can be a bit difficult, but obviously everyone has to go through it.
Very true. What about the squad as a whole? They seem like it's been tough times during the course of the season, but there's a sense of togetherness, I feel, when you see the Stoke kind of camaraderie together. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've just been on the cusp of it, really. Obviously, I think you see a completely different side. If we pick up a few results, it's just bubbling on the side, just waiting to kick in properly, and you'll see a lot better side sort of thing. But at the same time, obviously, we haven't been doing too well, but the dressing room hasn't like got poison or anything like that. It's still productive and everyone's wishing for each other to do the best, and every day in training is always teams working hard and trying to better ourselves.
So you joined in the summer. What was it about Stoke that was the attractive one that made you sign on the dotted line?
Obviously, I knew what big of a club it was and where it'd been previously, and I just wanted, with the project here, with a lot of the boys, I just wanted to get involved and hopefully try to push them back to where they need to be.
You came from a club, obviously, which had endured a lot of change and been part of the culture there for such a long period of time. From the outside looking in at what's happened to Newcastle United and how it's grown and the money side of it and the takeover and the different management, what was it like being on the inside of all that? Was it as dramatic as we were led to believe in the media?
Not really. I think the manager there tried to keep everyone grounded and together and tried to create like an atmosphere from inside sort of thing, not to worry about obviously what was going on the outside. And you can see it when they play each game, they're all fighting for each other and they're a team that are definitely together in that.
It's certainly a team as well that's kind of come on leaps and bounds. Is it fond memories across the board for your time at Newcastle?
Yeah, it's obviously one of my favourite places I was at. Obviously, I was there for 6 years and I started a family there. So I have very fond memories of the club, the city itself. And yeah, it's a really nice time for me.
I remember speaking to Matt Ritchie, who was a former teammate of mine at Swindon a very long time ago. And even back then, he was very... there's no other way of saying this, very moany. He always made sure that he told you exactly what he thought of you if you didn't pass in the ball. I don't think that's changed at all. Is Matt the same?
Not exactly the same.
It was good to know that he wasn't just the petulance of youth. That was just him as a person. But I remember one thing that he was talking to me about, this was a while ago. We were talking about the players that you played with and who he was playing with. And he was talking about you, yourself and Jonjo Shelvey and the telepathy it felt that you two both had playing in the same team together. And it was always something that kind of piqued my interest of when you are as a striker like yourself to play in front of someone with a passing range of a Jonjo Shelvey, that must be an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, of course. Like you say, it was some of my best years when I was playing with Jonjo. Like Matty mentioned, we obviously had a great connection and it started from training itself and led into the games as well. We'd always, as soon as he got it, sometimes I wouldn't even have to say sort of thing. He knew that I was going to be running for him and I knew that he'd be trying to play me in at the same time.
Let's go even further back. Darren Ferguson's just gone back in at Peterborough for the fourth time and having known him at a certain stage in your career, he was very glowing about you at the very early stages of your career. What was he like as a man and as a manager? Was he the right person at the right time for you, do you feel?
Yeah, obviously where I came from, like a lower league sort of thing, and I was on like a bit of a higher rise sort of thing very quickly. It moved very quickly. I remember I must have been playing non-league and then within 3 or 4 months I was playing championship level. And I think that he was a very strong man manager sort of thing. And I remember at one point I was just starting to get a bit confident sort of thing, and he gave me a little knockdown and then he felt sorry for me. So he got, I don't know if you know Lee Tomlin.
Yeah, yeah.
To go check on me and make sure I was all right. But no, he was a great manager and to be honest, there's a coach at Stoke now who was with him previously, and I sort of when I could see that he was going to go back, and I mentioned it to him. I was like, I bet Fergie goes back to Peterborough in a few months, and he did. So I wish him all the best, and he obviously has got a knack for getting the team up.
He has indeed, hasn't he? And you mentioned that jump between non-league and the Championship. What are the biggest differences that you encountered with that, and how tough did you find it? Because as history shows, and from what I've read, it didn't look too tough at all for you to adjust to life in the Championship.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, if looking back at it and thinking about it, it's just very surreal for me. It all happened so quickly, but I was just trying to just work as hard as I could. That was how I got to where I was. Always doing extras and listening to the coaches and trying to improve my game as much as I could. I was almost playing with a sense of freedom in terms of I was never expecting to get this far to where I was. So it was, whereas there might have been different types of stresses for the other players where they'd felt like they'd been around it for a while. It was just very new to me, and just went out each game and just tried to. And again, I had someone similar to Jonjo there. I had Lee Tomlin.
Yeah.
And I feel like we had a very good connection, and I thoroughly enjoyed playing with the 6 months with him as well.
So when you do eventually move on and you get into the Premier League, is it easy to remember your roots and where you've come from that helps you establish and flourish in the Premier League? Because as you said, with Darren Ferguson, there was that little time when he knocked you down a peg or two. But was that a lesson learned after that? Did that never happen again? Did you go and play higher up and you just took it all in your stride, but you were very grateful for where you were?
Not completely, because I think the Premier League's very tactical and very different. And I think me joining Crystal Palace, they was a team that got to where they was through all working hard for each other. They wasn't obviously expected to go up at the time. They obviously had a low budget, and the players there, and this is not me, we're not being horrible or anything, but they wouldn't see themselves getting promoted. But it was all about hard work, and it was, they obviously had to show me that at the beginning. And I knew obviously about hard working, but it just felt a bit different where their team was about more of a tactical side and maybe not going to beat teams by outplaying them and stuff, but being in the game and just complete team spirit, really. But I loved my time, especially at the beginning at Palace. I think in the first year I learned so much, and the boys really helped me.
Who was your strike partner at the time?
So obviously I had Glenn Murray, and then
is he ever cheery, Glenn? Every time I come across him, he's a miserable sod.
he's known as being the moodiest guy ever, but he's actually a good laugh. But he had too much fun when he's younger. And then when he eventually got kids, he then had to calm down a bit and just moan about everything.
Sorry, that's tickling. I mention it all the time when I see him. I say, for a man that's done it as much as he has and probably where he lives, I say, come on, you could at least raise a smile. But that's us from up north, mate, because it's that cold. We're quite curmudgeonly. Who else have you picked up along the way that you consider mates?
When I was at Palace, I remember Fraser Campbell.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it was towards the end of the first season, I just started to get back into the team properly and look like I was going to kick on, sort of thing. And then we was rumoured with signing Fraser Campbell. And I remember a few of the boys trying to wind me up about it, I think on a trip. he's going to take your place and stuff. Yeah. So I'm fuming about it, not thinking, who's this guy? And then we get back to the training ground and he's sitting next to me and I'm thinking, oh no, I don't need this. But then we ended up being really, really, really good mates, and we still speak now on it. So it's a bit of a weird one.
And again, because there's a presumption of the way that strikers are, isn't there, that they've got to be naturally selfish, they've got to be very single-minded. But the best partnerships I had the good fortune to play with, they were proper mates. And like you say, funny because you're vying for the same position, you want to be top of the scoring charts, you want to be the one that's setting the world alight. But without being able to appreciate what your teammate can bring, then the team suffers, doesn't it? So that's is that sounds something really organic that happened with Fraser Campbell?
Yeah, no, I think it's quite common. I think at the start, you obviously have a, oh, this guy's new, this guy, yeah, he's coming to take my place. But then after a while, you sort of, when you start to train with people, you start to realise you're both like fighting for the same thing, and it only helps both of you if you're both pulling in the same direction. You just start to grow relationships, and like you say, I think those are the best relationships between the people that are like fighting for the same similar place. Similar with goalies, they get like a little goalie team sort of thing, and they're all close.
They're very odd though, goalies, mate. So I understand if we move swiftly on away from. What about managers? Who sticks out? Who's been, if you are a Dwight Gale that's finished playing football in several years' time, who do you look back on and think they were important for me at certain times?
There's loads, really. Obviously, like I say, mentioned Fergie was a really good one. John Steele at Dagenham really gave me my opportunity and taught me a lot about football, obviously. And then Rafa was a big one. And then, if I'm being honest, I really enjoyed the 6 months I was with Eddie. Obviously, I didn't get to play as much as I would have liked, but I feel like I would I'd take so much from the way he managed and the way he coached. To be honest, it was thoroughly enjoyable, and you can see from what he does on the training ground why they're performing at this high level. They're just relentless.
Says a lot, doesn't it, when you can say good things about a manager that didn't necessarily play you every minute of every game. So that shows that, like you say, the job that he's doing, how he's gone about it, and also his experience working his way up through the footballing pyramid to get to a job the size of Newcastle United. He feels and he looks like he's the right man, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I remember, like you say, Matty and Fraser and Cal always talking about like being back at Bournemouth and how good Eddie was, and you sort of take it with a pinch of salt at the time, sort of thing. But then obviously working for 6 months, you start to see what they was talking about and the things that he worked on, and they was like, oh, you'd love him, and you can see why, because of what he does.
So let's flip it back now to Stoke between now and the end of the season. Obviously, it's the cup game at the weekend. Big win against Reading. Alex Neil's the man driving you forward. What's, and don't worry, you don't have to tell me any trade secrets here, but given how we've seen, say, a West Brom go through the gears, a Borough go through the gears, a way of putting results together that gets you up through a very congested table, the aims for Stoke between now and the end of the season, is the top six out of reach? Can you get there, do you think?
There's obviously a possibility. It obviously grows slimmer game by game if we don't pick up any points. I think I remember speaking to a lot of the boys saying about five games ago or six games ago, I think it was, and I was saying if we don't pick up points now, I know it seems tight, but there's just going to be too many teams at the time. And we know it's going to be difficult, but like you say, there's been teams that previously done it. I think that we need to get a few wins in the next games for sure to get the confidence up. I think that will help us massively, but we need to do it ourselves and prove to the fans that we're going to work hard and do it on the pitch, really.
And it's certainly something you know all about, promotion, isn't it? Can you give me one key ingredient that helps get a team over the line?
For me, in this division, I think it's mainly about being solid and being hard to beat. I think there's going to be mistakes made from this level of teams when you're playing out and stuff. So I think you can see teams like Luton, why they've done so well, they're making it difficult and not giving too much away on a defensive side. And I think if you have that in your key ingredient, I think you've got a big chance of doing well in this league. You obviously have the better sides that are playing football and getting out that way. But I think that's very difficult to do if you're making a team every year, sort of thing. It's not like similar same players that you have every week, every year, sorry.
Yeah. And given, I mentioned your age already, and it's not something to beat you over the head with, but signed it 2 years, if I'm right, you signed a 2-year deal at Stoke?
Yeah.
So 33 now, obviously you'll be getting towards the traditional time when footballers perhaps look away from the actual football pitch of playing. What's your aim, Dwight? Are you looking to make sure that you stick a pair of boots on for as long as possible? Is that the immediate aim?
It is, but obviously I have. I obviously looking forward to after football as well. I've started to do my badges, and like I say, when I'm talking about managers that I'm learning stuff from, it gives me like great interest in terms of what I want to do in the future, sort of thing. So it's something to think about for sure. And I don't think play for too long, because I just don't think it's probably effective if I'm not enjoying it or if it's not going too well. I'd rather give someone else an opportunity.
So coaching is something that you're actively looking forward to doing?
I'm doing it at the moment. It's not my definite choice, but it's something I've considered. And like I say, I fully enjoy it. And I love the coaching side in terms of training and seeing different exercises and what I think can improve players and the team, sort of thing. So it interests me for sure.
Would you ever go back to where it all began, Chingford Foundation School? Because let's be honest, it's got alumni that are pretty notable, if I'm right. David Beckham went there, Harry Kane went there, yourself went there. I mean, that's a hotbed. If you're going to go back and start scouting players or training players, surely that's the perfect place to start.
Yeah, it's obviously an area with a lot of players, and there's been a few others from like local, to be honest, that I played with as well. It's a nice area. There's certain clubs that create a lot of good players around the area, but I think this is quite similar with a lot of London, to be honest. There's good talent around the area.
That's what always fascinated me about, because I'm from Yorkshire, so a long way away from where you, I mean, you having lived in Newcastle, you know how far away these places are, but that sense of trying to make it as a younger footballer in quite a big area, but going down to the capital where it's so congested, where every young person of a certain age dreams about being a footballer, to be able to get through that process, to get through your process, how you got into the Football League. Was it not, straightforward is not the way to describe it. The dream was always there. How hard was it, Dwight, to get from the dream to the reality?
I think it's, ridiculously hard. You need a lot of luck on the way and things to land perfectly at your feet, sort of thing. And I know for a fact that that was my case as well. There's obviously so many good players in the area, and it's so difficult to stand out. I find it difficult in terms of, I feel sometimes a person's mentality or their personality can help them along the way. You definitely need a different personality for coming through in London than you would somewhere else, I think.
Yeah. I think as well, there was always an innate confidence, I thought, whenever you played London teams. There was always that sense of the players knew how good they were or knew how good they wanted to be. And it was, I think you're absolutely right. You talk about personality, it can help, but it can also hinder, can't it? I bet you've come across players that you think they should have done this, but because their approach was this, meant that they got nowhere near being a professional.
It's a fine line of confidence, and so it's just tough. You don't know the right answer, and sometimes someone's ability is like there to be seen, and they might not have the other side, and it just makes them unfortunate in terms of to make it.
Well, Dwight, this has been an absolute pleasure, mate. It's great to see you back amongst the goals and right here with us on the official EFL podcast. We wish you and Stoke City all the very best for the rest of the season, mate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure talking to you.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Okay, our second guest today on the official EFL podcast is the very antithesis of a footballing journeyman, having spent 27 years at just two clubs, cutting his managerial teeth at the club he started out with, Cheltenham Town. His stints at the Robins sandwiched a very successful 12-year spell at Burnley. Now he's leading Barnsley's charge back to the Championship. It's Tykes manager, Michael Duff. How are we, Michael?
Yeah, all good, mate.
Really good, really good. It's a pleasure to have you here along with us. And just to give it some context, you are away, you're a fair distance away from Barnsley, given the game that you've got coming up. But you're looking very salubrious surroundings.
No, we're in a nice hotel. Long day yesterday because I stayed at home at the weekend. So I left at 4:30 Monday morning to drive to Barnsley for a training session to drive 7 hours back to Exeter the other way. So it was a long day, but nice hotel, nice golf course to have a little look over and have a little wander this afternoon before the game.
I suppose it's a key thing, isn't it, when you talk about driving about. It's part of what a manager's remit is, because you've spoken very clearly about Cheltenham being your home, a place that you had wonderful success both as a player and a manager, and you actually made the choice to come away and go to Barnsley because you wanted to keep that sacred, really, the fact that you live there, your family live there, you want to go back and live there. You want to make sure that there's nothing that stops you being a fully paid up member of Cheltenham and what it is to live there and be part of that community.
Yeah, it's it's a big part of my life. I met my wife whilst playing for Cheltenham, and we always thought we'd stay in Manchester because I was in Burnley for such a long time. But the opportunity to get a job, a first team manager job at a club that I knew well, went better than expected. It was an opportunity to bring the family home in terms of my mum and dad live in the area, her mum and dad live in the area, brothers, sisters. So the whole sort of family setup is great. It went obviously better than expected. And then with the success that we'd had, I didn't want to outstay my welcome. I am ambitious. I did want to manage at the highest level, and I saw it at the next step. And it was always a case of my wife's like, well, I'm happy in my home now, so you can go and do what you want. So we sort of settled the family down. That's the base now. Nothing else. So that won't change. Kids are settled in school. And like I said, everything else's support systems are all in place. And I can crack on with what I love doing. And that's the management side of it.
I suppose that's the key thing as well, because as managers, when I speak to you lot that hang around at the Madhouse and love doing it and give everything of yourself to it, you have to be seen to be doing that as well as actually doing it yourself, don't you? If a manager's not there 24/7, the door's open for people to point the finger and say X, Y, and Z about a manager. To me, at times, it feels like a thankless task. And that side of it that you're talking about, away from your family, away from familiarity, shows the sacrifices that need to be made.
Yeah, I think that's probably one bit the supporters don't see. The sacrifices that on this side of it, what you have to do, it's not a case of when you are at home, you're on the phone most of the time anyway. But that's what the beauty of being able to set up in Cheltenham is, you know, the old saying, happy wife, happy life. So she's happy. So it makes my life a lot easier that I can go away and do what I need to do, knowing that she's got the support and the kids have got the support that they need. I obviously get back as often as I can, which again, it's the miles, but that's part of the job. There's no sympathy wanted from anybody else, but they're sort of like the hard yards that the people don't see. They think you just turn up to train, and there's not many people are lucky enough to live in the area and commute within 30 minutes. You've got to go where the work is, and that's why it's such a nomadic lifestyle.
I think as well, given the fact that we, as mentioned at the top, plenty of time spent in two places that you, of course, are well remembered in and you're very fond of, means that you understand exactly what it means to be a bit of a nomad as and when the chance is created, because it's much more precarious, isn't it, being a manager than it ever was or ever would have been for you being a player.
You said on the intro there, 27 years at two football clubs, unbelievably lucky to have had. I played 350 games from both, I think, and had three promotions with them both. So really lucky in terms of that side of it. And then you look at the world that we live in now, and you're only ever two or three games. With the arrival of social media, everyone's got an opinion, and it's normally the negatives are a lot louder than the positives, and come a lot quicker.
So talking about people and fans and the media focusing on things perhaps in a more negative way, you move to a new club, you have proven yourself, of course, at Cheltenham. Barnes is a different proposition altogether. Three wins in the first seven games and an October which didn't generate too many goals. Being able to work through that using the key pillars of your managerial career so far about working hard, not cutting corners, was that a real test to get through as boss of a new club?
Yeah, absolutely. It was coming in the summer, there were a lot of moving parts in terms of the club had just been relegated. Every player at the club seemed to want to leave. there was a disconnect between the supporters and the club. There'd been disruption at boardroom level. They wanted the youngest team in the league. So there was lots of things. I'm like, and that's never mind trying to, I think the 24, 25 players in and out during the course of a summer, lots of player sales. So just getting through the first window was a mission in itself, because with the season starting so early, I think there was a full month of the season still to be played whilst the window was still open. Mm. So that wasn't ideal, because there were players that clearly didn't want to be here. So that aside, and then trying to change the culture of the and the mindset of the whole place, it was tough. And then we went through four games where we never scored a goal and never really created a chance. And like you said, the noise starts quite quickly then. But I think in terms of the way that I've always been, I didn't win a game for 10 games at Cheltenham at the start. So there's no panic. I do firmly believe in that hard work pays you back. Don't look too far down the road. Just we had to tweak a couple of things. So we tweaked the shape again, because you know, if you keep doing the same thing, expecting a different result, I think someone more clever than me said it's madness. so that definitely helped. But I think the good thing from my point of view, I stay pretty consistent with the way that I am. I have done for years and years and years. I wasn't a very good player, but I managed to get to the top level based on my mentality. And I know now, even now, you know, we sit here now and I'm sixth in League One as a manager. That might be the highest I ever get.
Yeah.
But it won't be. If I was to get sacked tomorrow and I never get another job, I'll go, well, it wasn't through cutting corners. It was, I got my head down, I worked as hard as I could, and that was where my ability took me to. It was the same as a player. I retired at 38 knowing that I'd got every ounce out of my ability. So trying to convince the players that sticking to the process and just focusing on the next, you know, we break it down into halves, you try and win a half, put the music on at half time, then go again. And it's, luckily, we managed to pick up a few results, and then we've just won back-to-back manager of the month, and then we lose three games and the noise starts again. So it's it's just trying to stay as consistent as possible, because it's an emotional game, and the club was in an emotional state in terms of there was so much disconnect between everybody at the football club. It's just trying to piece it all together bit by bit.
It's the way that you talk then, and having known you when we've worked together doing games for Sky, the ability to be able to almost kind of look at yourself in the first person, but also look at yourself hovering above, to say that if you're the manager, you need to be a certain way. Because if, as you say, if you're overly emotional up and down, then the players are going to be like that. The club's going to be like that. You've got to be that calm head leading it forward. But that must be so difficult when there's so many variables that go into a football match that you can't control. How do you get your head around that?
I think I've worked under a lot of managers, but the one, probably because of the timing of it and the success that we had right at the end of my career, was with Sean Dyche. Mm. And I think that's what he's brilliant at, in terms of he didn't make anything personal. It's like the players don't lose because they don't like me, or it's there's a vendetta, or you know, I can give you loads of examples of when players have done something where at the start of my career, or you'd have done the same thing. That's right, that's him done now, isn't it? He'll never play for the football club again. Where it's like, well, we're not in a position where we can sort of cut our nose off to spite our face. And it's sort of having that calmness, which is why I try and stay consistent after the game. So I don't go running to the Ponty end at our place, like the cop, like beating my chest and doing all that. Because when we get beat 3-0, I don't do it. So I try and stay fairly consistent. Now inside, I'm buzzing, obviously, because I've won a game and I might last another week. But when we get beat, I can't just walk down the tunnel either. So you need to show your appreciation. And I think it's sort of staying as calm as possible, good and bad. When you're dealing with players as well, sometimes the players, I'm sure I do their head, and sometimes players do your head in, but they're not doing it on purpose sometimes. They're young people. They're young people. They make mistakes. And a lot of the mistakes they make, I've already done. So I'd be a hypocrite if I start coming down on them with like a ton of bricks and fine them 2 weeks wages for this. And it's like, well, no, let's have a chat. And if it happens again, we might have a few more serious problems. But just trying to, the same as with your children. You know, you don't fly off the handle with your kids after, because they've not said please or thank you for a couple of times. Now, if it keeps happening, then there's a different thing. But it's just trying to just take the emotion out of decisions as often as possible.
You sound like a way more patient parent than I am. I'm quite quick to say, any chance to say please or thank you.
Yeah, on a podcast.
Maybe that's just my
kids. When I'm at home, I rip the reds off.
Yeah, when you're out of earshot of everyone, they get the hard side of dad. Given what you've said there about players and discussing with players, and the fact that you are, to all intents and purposes, a younger manager, but obviously still several seasons into it now, that ability to chat to an 18, 19-year-old, a lad in his 20s, you know what I mean? Is that an ever-evolving thing? Have you found, because a lot of peers of mine who I either played against or played with have gone into management, there is a very throwaway cliche of, you mean, you can't talk to players nowadays. Now, that might be them not being able to do it because they don't have the skill set to be able to talk to the way players react nowadays. Have you found that, Michael? Have you been able to adjust and see that coming down the straight?
Well, I think asking questions is a lot of it. You know, I don't understand TikTok or anything like that. You know what I mean? I'm not going to pretend that I do. I don't understand all of a sudden 2 years ago, they were all wearing the tightest jeans in the world and now they're all wearing baggy tracksuits everywhere. So I don't pretend to like know, be sort of like current in pop culture and all that sort of thing. But I do chat to the players quite a lot, and a lot of it in terms of standards and what they want to do, I ask them what they want to do. Because then it's on them. It's irrelevant what I think or what I want to do. They have to be their words, whether the rules that they live by, the values that they have. We come up with them at the start of the season, and it's on them. Because it's easy for me to say, well, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. They have to live it. Mm. They have to police it. They have to, you know, if someone's cutting corners in the gym, it can't always be me or the staff. And if you can get that where they start policing themselves, that's when it starts becoming important. So how do you want this to look? How do you want that to look? Because I don't have to win every war or every battle. Mm. There's certain things I have to win. But a lot of it, if they come up with the rules and they come up with this is what we want to achieve, okay, well, my job is to help them. Well, how do we achieve that? And then there's a buy-in, because it has to be a two-way street. It always has to be a two-way street. There's no good me pontificating at the front of a room and saying, well, do this, do that, because they just lose interest. Because ultimately, they don't know whether I was a player or not. They've forgotten, because they soon forget. I don't look like a footballer anymore. So it's it's all right me talking, well, I did this and I did that and you should do this and you should do that. They're not listening. If you can engage them by conversations and finding out what interests them, where they want to go, what motivates them. I don't care what motivates them. It might be money. It might be promotions. It might be driving a Ferrari. It might be having a model girlfriend. It's irrelevant. I don't care what it is, as long as it drives them to success. And that's what we're trying to achieve.
I think that's reflected in just recent comments that I've read from yours, when in relation to Mads Andersen, Brad Collins and Jordan Williams, contract extensions for them. Obviously, it's a two-way street, as you say, and it helps the football club, doesn't it, to protect their assets. And if anything happens and they move on, then you get, hopefully, the going rate for those particular players. But the example that you were saying about getting to the Premier League at 20, you know, the back end of your career being heavily stacked in success, getting to the very highest level, when perhaps for quite a while you might have been thinking, well, this is it for me. This is as good as it's going to get. But sticking to it, sticking to those principles. And the key thing that comes out, everything that I've read, everything that the bits, the interviews, the kind of profiles, that word, that the sentence about not cutting corners is absolutely manifested in what your career was as a player, wasn't it? To get to 38, to literally wring every single ounce of what you had and to get to the top level of what club football is, the Premier League, to be able to say that I played in the Premier League and did a cracking good job at it as well. That's the example that you set into your players.
Yeah, and I think, again, as a manager or an older person, you've got life experience which you're trying to sort of hand down and pass down, but without it sounding like a head teacher. I was the best thing that ever happened to me is I had a career-threatening knee injury at 29. So at the age of 29, my wife was pregnant with my first child. I had 3 years left on a contract, and it was the wake-up call of all wake-up calls, because I literally sat with the surgeon. He said, you're done, you're finished. Now, luckily, fast forward 12 months, I wasn't. But it was that wake-up call of, because you can take it for granted as a player. It does become a job. it does become, oh, I've got to go in, I've got to do that. And I know supporters might not like to hear that sometimes, but it is. It's a grind sometimes. And that was, well, I've got a second chance here. So I am doing everything I can. And then, like you said, I managed to somehow get three promotions after from the age of 31 onwards into the Premier League. And it was sort of living every day like it's your last. And it's hard to do that every day. It's the same as, you know, you buy a new car. Everyone's like, right, I'm going to clean it every week. They don't. You have it 3 months and it's filthy and there's someone right, wash me, please, on the back of your car. But it's just trying to remind them that don't have those regrets. Your career might finish tomorrow, and don't finish going, I wish I'd have done that. I should have done this. And it's difficult. It's, you know, there's loads of examples and just reminding them of what they can do. And we have got a young group. So we are naive at times, but we've got brilliant energy, we've got brilliant enthusiasm and coachability in terms of the prepared to listen. And so from my point of view, that's all you can ask for. And I say to them all the time, if the team wins, we all win. So the 11 that are on the pitch at any one moment in time, they're the most important, because you might get released. You might get released at the end of the season, but if you've been released from a team that's been promoted, you're going to get another club. If you've been released from the team that's just been relegated, it's a little bit more difficult. So it's just trying to have that buy-in all the time. If they're all important, but on a match day, it's the 11. And when you come off, a sub comes on, sub comes off, some comes on, he's now more important than you for that one moment.
Yeah.
So leave your ego, check, you know, park that up, just come off the pitch, and then you want a conversation, we'll have a conversation on the Monday when the emotions come out of it.
Well, it's certainly an intriguing League One that we're looking at this season, given the wonderful stats about how many clubs are actually in League One that play in the Premier League. Plymouth currently top, Sheffield Wednesday in second, Ipswich third, Derby fourth, Bolton fifth, Barnsley sixth, Peterborough behind you, 5 points behind you, which is a nice little cushion. And you've got a couple of games, if not one game, on most teams above you. Is it so far so good then, given where you are, Michael?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was, no one really knew, because like I said, there was so much disruption at the start of the season of players in, players out, who's staying, who wasn't, trying to put a new board together, new manager together, new staff together, new ideas, new cultures, all these sorts of things. So I said before my first interview, I don't like making predictions anyway, because going back to what we've just said previously, it's just win the next game. I think talk's cheap. Just get your head down and work. And wherever you end up, you end up. So every now and again, you stick your head above the parapet and you go, right, well, in the top six, not in a bad place. So you look at, like I said to you, we've sold millions and millions of pounds worth of players in the summer and not spent a penny. So there needs to be a realism within the finance situation of where the club's at. But we've got some good players as well who want to achieve. So one thing they have done is, I said to you earlier, they've been receptive to new ideas. They are prepared to work hard. We've been a little bit unlucky recently. I think we've had 5 penalties given against us in 6 games, which is a run that I've never been involved in. But we've given ourselves a chance. I don't think anyone knew what was going to happen this year, whether we were going to instantly bounce back or whether sometimes you see clubs have double dips. Now, I don't think we're going to get relegated, so that's one positive to start with. But it's recognising where we're at, how we've got there, and then how we finish the second half of the season stronger, because hopefully we can do that, because we don't have as much chaos in terms of gluing things together, because it's already, the group have been together for 25 games now.
I thought it was a great line when you said about the difference in being at a club like a Cheltenham and now at Barnsley, which is a bigger club. There's no kind of disgrace in saying that compared to Cheltenham. It was a club that was only a couple of games away from the Premier League, wasn't it? Just a couple of seasons ago. But you said that every pound was a prisoner at Cheltenham and you knew what was going on at every single level. I'm not saying for one second that's not the case at Barnsley, but with it being a bigger beast, there's more things to keep an eye on. Therefore, there's more staff needed to keep an eye on that. That allows you to do your job as the man that puts the team out to get the results. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, even the title's different at Barnsley. It's head coach. So in terms of, I couldn't tell you what our budget is. I don't know what the budget is. I don't do negotiation with players in terms of contract. The recruitment's slightly different as well. So that was part of my learning, is, well, what is the actual job role? Because at Cheltenham, I was in control of every decision, every player that went in, every player that went out, me and the director of football in terms of wages. It's like, right, we're not going any more than that on this player. That's not my role at this football club. My role is trying to pick the team and make the players better. Now, I am involved in the recruitment process. It's not a case of, like, deal with him. But it is a bigger operation. I can't be in control of everything. So part of my learning early on is, well, what are the important things that I need to be in control of, and what can I delegate to other people? Because I don't want to spend a dead time on things that aren't important. So I mentioned it at the start in terms of players. You don't have to win every battle with every player. I don't have to do everything. Mm. You know, if I take a day off on a Monday, the football club's still going to be standing. But at the start of my career, you think you're that important that no one can survive without you. And you realise pretty quickly they can. So I think that's in terms of my own time as well. Like getting an hour away, and just whether it's going on the exercise bike or having a game of pool in the kit room or something like that, just to switch your mind off for an hour. So it's, that's been the main difference between the two, is learning who, not who you can trust, but trying to implement to the staff what I would expect from them, so I don't have to keep checking over my shoulder and make sure that they're doing that right in the gym and they're doing that right in the physio room. And it's sort of implementing my ideas and then delegating it. But with the delegation and the responsibility, there comes accountability within that. So if the staff members aren't doing what I want to do, then we have to have a different conversation. But I can't be running around checking up on everybody, because it is too big an operation now.
Given what you're saying there about the role of a head coach and what it is to be within a framework, there's only really, if you looked further at the footballing pyramid, say the likes of Pep Guardiola or Jurgen Klopp, that would be in that position where they had total kind of dominance within the football club of what goes on. Even then, there's, as we know, sporting directors, there's heads of recruitment. So the position that you find yourself in as a younger coach, not as a young coach, but as a younger coach, being a head coach within a big football club, it seems to me at this day and age, that's going to be more common than the old school manager would be anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's sort of transitioned as I've come out of playing. There's a lot more coaches now than actual managers. I think clubs want one person to maybe come in and come out, rather than having to pay up a whole team of staff. When, you know, in the old days, you'd have to, the manager would take his goalkeeper coach, his first team coach, assistant manager, physio, and sports site, everything, and it becomes expensive. So I think it's a financial thing from clubs, and they're just trying to implement. You look at what successful teams that have done it really well are teams like Brighton and teams like Brentford, sort of like the modern day in terms of data recruitment and analysis, and just having one person come in and come out, maybe a couple of people. So the whole ethos of whatever they want at that football club stays the same. The only thing that needs to change is the head coach. And I came in fully understanding that, knowing that it's a differently run football club, but it's been great in terms of my learning. You know, they wanted to play a certain type of football. So the responsibility was to play that type of football. But it's been a massive, massive learning curve. I've learned so much in the last 6 months, and I've really enjoyed the challenge.
That's the thing that I always try, and when I speak to managers and coaches, we covered the Burnley West Brom game on Friday night at Turf Moor, obviously a place you know very, very well indeed, and Vincent Cummins is doing a wonderful job. And he came and joined us pitch side, and a very focused, very driven individual. And it always strikes me when I get a chance to talk to very focused and committed people like yourself, Michael, is the enjoyment. Is it fun being a manager, or is that the daftest question you've ever heard?
I like every day of being a manager apart from match day. You know, I often say I hate match days, because you work all week and you try and the things that you're in control of, and like you say, and then it's your job is in other people's hands. And I don't just mean the players. That could be a referee. It could be a linesman. It could be just the opposition. They're just better than you. Yeah. Sometimes you'll get outdone, whether it's, you know, tactically or some, you pick the wrong team and things like that. But it's, you're hanging around even like today. So, you know, you wake up at 8 o'clock this morning and I've got 12 hours to kick my heels and go through all the things that might happen, that might not happen, that I'm not in control of any of it. So yeah, I don't enjoy a match day. I'm quite happy saying that. But the rest of it, no, the rest of it, I love it. It's, you know, I didn't do particularly well at school, so the only thing I could do was head of football. And at the end of my career, I learned a little bit of some good people and some good managers. And it's the thing that people talk about it being a drug and things like that. It is. I'm lucky that I've never come out of it since the age of 17. So I've been in it since, you know, I've been in it for 28 years now. So I've not come out of it. I don't feel like I need a break yet. You know, you speak to managers and sometimes they say, no, I needed it. I needed to come out and I needed to energise and re-energise and things like that. I don't feel like that at the minute. I still consider myself as young-ish. I'm 250 games in now. So I have got a body of work, so to speak, but I think I've got a lot more to learn and hopefully a lot more time in the game.
And given more to learn, more time in the game, the immediate future, given where you are in the league, sixth, should we be looking at Barnsley for an outside shout for promotion? Are we looking at a team that's going to mix it up in the playoffs? Presumably that is now the aim, given where you are.
Yeah, I think we'd be naive to just say, well, we'll just see where we finish. Now, we've given ourselves an opportunity, but you look at some of the teams behind us, the top three look like they've got away a little bit. Yeah. Derby are on an unbelievable run with a good manager, knows out the league, fantastic football club, support, everything, and players that go with it. And then you're looking at, you know, Peterborough, people like Darryl Ferguson going in, and Oxford, Charlton, Portsmouth. There's some big football clubs, and that's not being disrespectful to your Bristol Rovers and your Shrewsbury's and your Exeter's that have been putting brilliant seasons together as well. So it's a tough league. It really is a tough league. As you said at the start, the amount of ex-Premier League clubs there are in the league, it's tough. But it's a really good league in terms of it is competitive. Mm-hmm. So the challenge is now is we've given ourselves a chance. Can we sneak in and then we see what happens from there.
It's been a pleasure, Michael, for you to join us on the official EFL podcast from a suite, the honeymoon suite, I presume, is it, in this luxurious Exeter City hotel that you're in?
Yeah, it's wasted sitting here on my own, but it's been a pleasure. Like I said, breaking up the day before of the game, so it's been great to speak to you, Prox.
So a glimpse there of the ever glamorous life of a football manager on the road with his team. Well, that's about it for this episode. A big thank you to Michael Duff and Dwight Gale for joining me this week on the official EFL podcast. As always, if you've enjoyed it, then please do give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share on all of your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's David Prutton and we'll see you back here same time next week for another episode of
the official EFL podcast.